Success Match Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
It's hump day on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports. It's the Brad Sesmat Show. My name is Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat today. Hey, he's the father of the groom, a lot of responsibilities, so I'll do my best to get us through this show and get us through the rest of the week. And we've got a great show coming up here today. Kyle Odegaard, one of the up-and-coming Cardinal writers around the Valley. Big fan of Kyle, a friend of mine, and he's going to be joining us. Hey, there was a big trade yesterday. Chandler Jones, one of the top pass rushers in football. No, he's not Von Miller. No, he's not J.J. Watt. I keep hearing these arguments of, oh, well, he's not Von Miller or J.J. Watt. You know, not everyone is LeBron James or Kevin Durant. Not everyone is Peyton Manning or Tom Brady. But you're getting a premium player at a premium position, and it just so happens to be the position the Cardinals needed most this offseason. So we'll talk more about the trade with Kyle, plus I'll give my thoughts about it as well. Joining us in studio, still more football to talk about, head coach of the Northern Arizona University Lumberjacks, Jerome Sowers. He will join us in studio. Love the coach, love what he has done in state, especially over the last 4 years. And it just so happens he's really been doing it for the last 18 years, but the last 4 years especially, he's really planted his roots. He likes 50% of his program to be from the state of Arizona. And as a result, they've become one of the top Big Sky programs year in and year out. And they just so happen to have a quarterback that was the FCS Freshman of the Year. Not a bad spot to be in when your quarterback has 3 years to go and is already off to a great start. So we'll be joined by the head coach coming up here in about a half hour. First, let's get into a little bit about the Chandler Jones to the Cardinals trade. Now, one of the things that you have to keep in mind in with this trade is it's not about Jonathan Cooper. Okay, Jonathan Cooper, former seventh overall pick of the Arizona Cardinals, he wasn't the main piece in this trade. And while it's sad to see a guy go literally before he scratched the surface, I don't consider him a bust by any means. He hasn't really had the time. He had a severe knee injury, and those are not easy to come back from. I mean, you look at, they make it a requirement at the college level that every offensive lineman wear knee braces. They all do. And it's not just by a technicality or because it's a preference. They do it because they have to, because they want to protect these guys' knees, because it's a dangerous thing to not only endure, but also come back from. And it's not until they get to the pros where they decide whether or not they want to wear them. Jonathan Cooper's knee injury was severe, and clearly the mental hurdle to come back from it has been an issue, but he is by no means a bust. He looked fantastic in those first few preseason games before that injury, but he is not the main piece of this trade. This trade, from the Patriots' standpoint, is all about money. You look at what the Patriots have in front of them, they've got some pretty big contracts that they're going to have to address next offseason if they want to maintain the success that they've had over the years. Sure, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick alone will get you to the playoffs and beyond, but you need the depth around it. And it's clear to see when you have guys like Dante Hightower, Malcolm Jenkins, the Super Bowl hero, among others that are going to be coming off the books really next offseason, plus Chandler Jones, you've got to make decisions ahead of time. I think this is a savvy move by the Patriots to think ahead the way they have. Because you look at the money that Olivier Vernon brought in from the New York Giants coming from the Miami Dolphins, it's crazy to think about the money that Chandler Jones, who I believe had much more production than Olivier Vernon did last season, just from an overall standpoint. You think about the money that could result in Chandler Jones being paid next offseason. He is in the final year of his contract. $7.8 million he is due this season. What does that mean for the Cardinals? Well, one, this season, at minimum, they add a premier pass rusher. And I mentioned it's at a position that they needed in the worst way. When it comes to paying Chandler Jones, think of it this way. I've heard this tossed around on Twitter as well. You have the $7.8 million, and you have the opportunity to franchise tag him at the end of this season. Now, some of the numbers that I've seen floated around, maybe $15, $16 million. So you do the math, $7.8 plus $15 million, that's in the $22 million range for two seasons. And then you think about what Olivier Vernon is being paid now coming off of free agency. I think the Cardinals ended up way better now than they would have if they threw all this money at either Jason Pierre-Paul or Vernon, because now they are not strapped to a huge contract long term. They're being presented with an outside linebacker that they're calling it, or defensive end, a pass rusher that they own for 2 years. And guess what? The window you're looking at if you're the Arizona Cardinals is 2 years with Carson Palmer. So I think this is just a fantastic move. It's not about losing Cooper. It's more about the money from the Patriots standpoint, and if they get a great player in Cooper in the end. Unfortunate for the Cardinals, but it was not something that they'll look back on and think, that was not a smart move to make. They traded a great young offensive lineman in the end. They don't know what they have at this point. They made the move they needed to make and gave up what they needed to give up. And it just so happens that it's at the position they need most. And it's going to create some great flexibility for them with what they decide to do with the 29th overall pick. Before we go to Kyle next segment, I want to touch briefly on March Madness, because, man, the madness is upon us. Starting tomorrow, we kick off the first day. I mean, I guess last night was the first official night, the play-in games, and it had some relevance here in Arizona as Wichita State knocked off Vanderbilt 70-50. Now, what I would like to do is kind of go inside the numbers here. You know, I know a lot of people aren't really into analytics. I'm kind of on the fence, analytics versus what I test, what I see on the floor. I like dabbing in both of them, but there are things that there are a lot of keys when you look at the numbers with this matchup between Wichita State and Arizona. And one of the biggest things is, and I saw this number, College Basketball Reference. Any what is it, Football Reference, NBA Basketball Reference, collegebasketballreference.com. This is one of the best websites out there in terms of stats, analytics, numbers, and history and everything. And I'm a purist for basketball, so looking this stuff up is just a hobby of mine, to be honest. But two teams are ranked sixth in the NCAA with tournament wins since 2013. One of them being the Arizona Wildcats. They have 8 wins. But another team after last night has 8 wins since 2013, and that is Wichita State. So this is a team that comes in with guys like Baker and Van Fleet, who have experience, that are seniors at the guard position, that have come in and aren't your typical mid-major. These guys have been here, they're battle-tested, and they know what to do. And guess what? They are fantastic defensively. The number that you have to keep an eye on, the Shockers allow just 59.4 points per game. And you can say, well, the level of play that they're against isn't the same as the Pac-12. Maybe the numbers would be inflated. All I know is holding a team less than 60 points per game is an unbelievable accomplishment at the college basketball level. What the Wildcats need to do is they need to get to the foul line. Wichita State allows, what's the number here? They are 329th in the nation in free throw attempts allowed per field goal allowed. So that means guys like Alonzo Trier, Caleb Tarzewski, Ryan Anderson, those guys need to get to the foul line. If the Wildcats commit to shooting from the outside, it's not going to set them up for success. Yes, they've had a few games here late, especially that Stanford game most notably, where they were raining threes. That's not their comfort zone. That's not where they're at their best. And if they're hitting them, great. That's going to help. That's just a cherry on top. They need to get to the foul line. They need to put up free throws. Wichita State team is a great rebounding team. So it's all about the Wildcats attacking the hoop and getting high percentage shots, because a lot of misses could result in defensive rebounding opportunities for Wichita State and extra possessions, and also them not getting to the foul line, because that has been one of the Achilles heels of Wichita State throughout the season. We're going to take a short break. Kyle Odegaard is going to join us next to talk about the Arizona Cardinals and the big trade they made from azcardinals.com. Friend of mine, friend of the show, excited to have him on. That's coming up next. Again, I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat on the Brad Sesmat Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. The Cardinals really, really made noise yesterday with this trade they made with the New England Patriots. Chandler Jones coming to the Valley of the Sun. They get that pass rusher that they've been coveting. My name is Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat today on the Brad Sesmat Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. And we're going to talk Cardinals now with one of my favorite people in the industry. This is a guy that I've gotten to know very well over the last 4 or 5 years, not just covering the Cardinals, but high school sports. He's one of the best out there. Kyle Odegaard joins us. KO, how are things? How's life?
Doing well, man. That's quite the intro. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, well, first thing I want to know about is how much time you spending at Sloan Park these days, and what are your thoughts on the Cubs winning the World Series? Do you think this can actually happen?
Oh, no doubt. I've been over there just once. I'm going this weekend as well. I think a team like that, as good as they were last year, adding Zobrist, adding Jason Hayward, pretty pumped for the Cubs season this year. I have high hopes.
You and me both, man. You and me both. So let's get into the Cardinals now. That's your bread and butter at the end of the day. Now, the Chandler Jones trade comes down, and I think the craziest part about all this, Kyle, is the fact that normally with trades of players of this magnitude, you at least hear rumors of guys being shopped or rumors of maybe someone leaking this could be in the works. This seemingly came out of nowhere. No one was expecting it and created a shock value that I think really turned a lot of heads nationally.
Oh, absolutely. And you wonder, you know, you were kind of following the Cardinals through free agency, and there was the interest in Jason Pierre-Paul, which didn't work out. And after that, you saw all those other pass rushers going to different teams. And the thinking was maybe they'll be able to find a veteran guy for cheaper that maybe comes in and could help, or maybe they're going to have to go to the draft. So the fact that they did this to get a guy who's 26 years old in the prime of his career, a guy who's already played at a Pro Bowl level and is a double-digit sack guy, it was a big-time surprise. And definitely understand the thinking behind it. They really needed a pass rusher, and to go get a guy like Chandler Jones is going to be a big help.
I feel like, Kyle, with the way this has all come together at the end of the day, it worked out better for the Cardinals. Yes, they lost a draft pick and they lost a former first round pick in the process, but they're not strapped to a long-term crazy deal like we saw some of the money that was being thrown out for free agency. We had Lee Steinberg, a sports attorney, on the show earlier this week. He's the agent for Paxton Lynch, just so happens, this year. And he talked about how this offseason with free agency, you're getting B-plus players at A-plus contracts. They're not giving an A-plus contract just yet to Chandler Jones, but he is an A-plus player. And I feel like at the end of the day, they made out better in the end than they would have if they added a Pierre-Paul or a Olivier Vernon in the end.
Yeah, I agree with that. Obviously, you're paying for a lot of potential with Olivier Vernon. He doesn't have the numbers that a guy like Chandler Jones has. So Vernon could possibly be that guy, but you feel like with what Chandler's done already that you have a really good idea that he's going to be an impact player at pass rusher. And like you said, for only $8 million this year, it's a really good price. If he plays well, he's obviously going to get paid moving forward, and the Cardinals can kind of decide if that fits into their budget or if he's going to be too expensive. But knowing that Carson Palmer is at the end of his career, knowing that Larry Fitzgerald's towards the end of his career, they're definitely in this championship window. They needed a pass rusher. So I agree that you got one of the better ones in the NFL at a really good price. And you obviously had to give up Jonathan Cooper in a second-round pick, so it's not like he just came for free. But I definitely agree with you that you found a guy that can be a dominant player at a really good price.
Kyle Odegaard joining us from azcardinals.com. You were around the facility every day, obviously. Jonathan Cooper, you know, there were some points where people thought that, you know, maybe he was starting to improve and there was light at the end of the tunnel. And then there was some signs from the coaching staff that, you know, maybe he's not putting it together. From you being down there every day and around the team as much as you are, did you see Jonathan Cooper starting to turn things around, or was this a case of the team really didn't know what to do with him, and that's why the notion of trading him became something they would look into?
Yeah, I think it was still a question mark. Obviously, when you have a pedigree like that, you're the seventh overall pick in your draft, you have the talent, but he broke his leg early in his career and was kind of fighting other injuries and wasn't super effective when he was playing. So it wasn't like you expected him to go in at right guard and just be a dominant player next year. It was still up in the air. And obviously he has the potential to get there, and maybe New England can get something out of him that they weren't able to get out of him in Arizona. But it's definitely not something where you know he's going to be this starter or Pro Bowl type guy. I mean, Cooper, who knows what's going to happen for the rest of his career. So I feel like the team would have given him a shot to be a starter next year, but they didn't have the complete faith that he would be this dominant player that they wanted him to be when they drafted him.
Kyle, you look at now the offensive line situation. Bobby Massey went off to Chicago. Now Jonathan Cooper's off at New England. The whole right side of the line, a lot of question marks. It was reported that Evan Mathis was given a two-year contract, and also Jeff Schwartz was in for a visit. Are these pieces that you think are realistic options that can come through? And honestly, how do you see this offensive line shaping up at the end of the day? Is DJ Humphreys the guy, or are they going to continue to look elsewhere?
It sure seems like Keim loves to, you know, bring in guys. And even though I think DJ Humphreys obviously being a first-round pick last year, not playing at all. He wants to start, and it's something where if they put him in there, you do want to give him a chance to play and see what he's made of. But Kaim is also very open to things where if you can get a different guy and for a value contract and you bring him in, so you can have competition or you have depth in case of an injury, I think he's always open to that. He's not just set on one thing. So it wouldn't shock me if they brought in a tackle to compete with DJ Humphries. And obviously, they're going to need a guard and a center. Lyle Sunline and Ted Larson are both free agents, and it's not known if they're going to come back or not. So I think it's really fluid right now, and time his MO is pretty clear in free agency where he has a target price in mind for a certain guy, and that's what he's going to offer. And if the guy wants to come, then he'll take him. And if the player looks around, then he's going to look at a different option. So I think time is always is kind of a step ahead of what we're seeing. We don't know exactly what he's doing. He has a good idea of what's going on. So I'm sure by the time we get to training camp, he's going to have some good options on the right side.
Let's talk draft a little bit, because I think with this move by getting Chandler Jones, it creates a lot of flexibility. You're not handcuffed to being like, well, you know what? We need a pass rusher. Let's reach and try to get the best one available, even if he's not 29th overall grade. You know, I think you get a lot more flexibility looking at a corner or a safety or an offensive lineman, or maybe there is a pass rusher there. But how do you see this going now? I mean, center, there's a lot of good centers that could be late first, early second round grades. Maybe they look at that. How do you see this all starting to play and come together now that a move like this has been put in place?
Yeah, I think it can be dangerous when you had a glaring hole like you had at edge rusher before you got Chandler Jones. The feeling is like, okay, at 29, even though we might have a mid-second round grade on a guy, we really need a pass rusher, so maybe we'll reach. And like you said, now it's just open to where they can really take best player available, because there aren't really that many holes left on the team. And if you really like a safety, you can take a safety and make it fit, or a cornerback, or an offensive lineman, or even, you know, a wide receiver. It looks like they have three really good wide receivers, but with Larry Fitzgerald and Michael Floyd having expiring contracts, if you really like a guy, you bring him in and maybe ease him in the next couple of years. So I think it really allows them to make their big board and list the guys, you know, from one to, I think they go to 300, and then they can really just take that guy that they feel like is the best, no matter at what position, because they're so balanced and I think really have a really good roster construction right now where there aren't any big needs.
Couple more for you real quick. Kyle Odegaard joining us from azcardinals.com. You mentioned Michael Floyd, and you know there was a lot of talks going into the offseason with what the team will do before he goes into the final year of his deal. Have you heard anything new on that front, or do you anticipate something before training camp breaks?
I think it'll be tough, just because seeing what the wide receivers got on the open market, Floyd's going to be a young guy who's produced, and I think his price tag will probably be pretty high. So from his perspective, I'm not sure if he's going to be in too big of a hurry to sign an extension unless the Cardinals are willing to meet his terms. So I'm sure, you know, the two sides will probably talk about it, but it's something where, you know, he knows he could probably get a lot of money on the open market, and the Cardinals would have to be willing to meet those demands to lock him up.
And another name that popped up, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, right before we started talking, Kyle, I saw that Carlos Dansby was released by the Cleveland Browns. Is this another, you know, third time's the charm, bring Carlos back, win a Super Bowl on a one-year deal that Kime pulls out, or has this ship sailed with Carlos Dansby?
It just broke, so I'm not really sure what they're thinking. And I know he's, I think, 34 now, so he's an older guy. But if they still think he can play, obviously they did it a couple years ago and he was great in Arizona. So I'm sure they'll look at him, watch the tape. It sounds like if he comes back, it obviously wouldn't be for a lot of money. So I think it's a possibility. I don't know exactly what they're thinking, but it does make some sense if he wants to come back and if they're interested for the two sides to work it out. But I know he's probably going to have quite a few options as well.
One last one for you, Kyle. You know, before you were over with the Cardinals, you did a lot on the high school front in the East Valley with the East Valley Tribune, and a couple guys that you covered quite a bit DJ Foster, Christian Westerman when they were at the high school ranks. Now at the Combine, you were there to see them at the Combine. What are your overall thoughts about these former Valley Prep guys that are looking to get into the NFL and possibly be drafted in the, maybe the first couple days of the draft, and what you see for them going forward, what could be good fits?
Yeah, with Westerman, it was interesting because he played tackle, and he was such a good tackle in high school, and now it sounds like he's an interior guy. I haven't watched him too much, but it sounds like he can be a guard or a center, kind of a strong guy. So from what, you know, the reports are, maybe like a second, third, fourth round pick, something like that, which would be good for him. I'm not sure where he would fit, but that versatility I think is important, because even if he can't start as a rookie, being able to be a swing guy or a depth guy, being able to do multiple positions really helps when you only have a certain number of roster spots. So I think a few teams, it would make sense if a couple different teams like him, and I think he'll definitely get drafted in the middle rounds. And I know DJ, I think he had a pretty good pro day with his speed, which was important because he's the type of guy who's going to do the, sounds like the hybrid running back, wide receiver, slot receiver role. And you have to have a little bit of speed to do something like that. So it sounds like maybe a late round pick. I don't think he's going to go too early. But, you know, we've both covered him, and very high character guy. Seems like a good guy, would be good in the locker room and kind of a jack of all trades type thing. And with the way the NFL is going, where all these running backs are catching the ball more, I think it could be a valuable piece. So I'd expect him to go in the later rounds.
Kyle, we used to be young guys covering this stuff, and now guys that we watched even as underclassmen in high school are declaring themselves for the NFL draft, so it's kind of crazy to see how quick the time goes. I appreciate you joining us today, man.
Making me feel old.
I'm right there with you, buddy.
Thanks, Jared. Appreciate it.
Of course. That's Kyle Odegaard joining us from azcardinals.com. Really good stuff on the Cardinals trade and what they could be moving forward, plus with the draft. Appreciate the time with Kyle. Coming up next in studio, Jerome Sowers, head coach of NAU football. He'll sit down on the couches with me to talk about his program and the great recruiting class that they have coming in. That's coming up next on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. The NAU Lumberjacks, 7-4 last season, been on a phenomenal run, and we are thrilled to be joined in studio right now by the program leader, the head coach, Jerome Sowers, joining us here in studio. And coach, this run you guys have been on through the Big Sky has just been so much fun over the last few seasons. What's it been like within the program? It has to be a lot of excitement each and every year to get back out on the field.
You know, it really has. And having the good fortune of being there for 18 years, we have a lot of perspective, and to be able to look at the, you know, the last four seasons in particular, and you know, look at the number of wins, the intrinsic value of our program, how much better the student athletes are coming into our program, and the kind of product we're putting out on the field and in the classroom and in the community, it's been exciting to see.
Now, you recruit every player as if envisioning that they can be a star. You don't recruit guys to maybe be a role player. You don't recruit some to be starters. You don't tell kids, you know, I can see you coming in off the bench. It's not like that, especially in recruiting. Could you have ever envisioned, though, Case Cookus coming in year one as a freshman and having the year that he had?
That's about as a great a dream as you might ever think of. You know, someone that comes in and just sweeps you off your feet like Case did. And he really did. He came in with very little experience, very little, you know, to show in regards to tape. But he came in, and here I am. And he showed up, and all he's done is worked hard, kept a real humble attitude about the game and what a student of the game that he is. And to come out last year the way that he did and put up 37 touchdowns over five picks is just unheard of. And so, you know, we're excited about see what's he going to do next, you know, and that's what's coming up this fall.
When you have a guy that has 3 years ahead of him, it not only sets up the program great, but it could set him up great for his future. You look at the draft coming up, Carson Wentz, North Dakota State. Then you look at Paxton Lynch, excuse me, Memphis. Mid-major programs that have quarterbacks that could go first round. You see a guy like Case, not only is off to a great start within the program, but he could really be setting himself up in the future.
Well, I do. And I think, you know, very special prospects like Case have that deep down inside. You know, they know they're destined for greatness, and yet that doesn't overwhelm them. You know, they work hard, they keep a humble attitude, and Case has been a great model, a great leader for the players in our program to say, this is how you do it. And so, you know, excited about the things that he's, you know, putting in just by himself, but what a great model he is for the other players in the program, you know, about how important it is to be unselfish, how important it is to, you know, see the bigger picture and putting team first. And, you know, Case Cook is that kind of guy.
Coach, I'm born and raised here in Arizona, and there's nothing more rewarding as a native seeing natives really do well and exceed at the college ranks and then on to the pro ranks. And when I look at your receiving corps specifically, you look at what Emmanuel Butler did last season. You look at Elijah Marks over at Desert Edge, who is really coming into his own. And even a guy like Dan Galindo coming from Pinnacle that you expect to make a big impact. These are all homegrown guys at your deepest position, arguably. It's fun from an outsider's point of view to see what you've been able to accomplish.
You know, it has, because we lost key guys. Dijon Walker from Bashaw High School was a five-year producing guy and tremendous senior year last year. And we lost Alex Holmes, you know, out of Chaparral, and even R.J. Rickert, who is a tight end receiver. There's a lot of guys that have been very productive in our program, but to see Emmanuel Butler, you know, prepared to emerge, and Elijah, and Dan Galindo, and of course we get off of a redshirt is Patrick Baldenegro from Chandler High School, a notable tight end receiver type. So, you know, more guys coming in and stepping in to replace the production that we lost, and to be excited about the fact that we can continue this movement, this trajectory forward. And so I'm thrilled. I know our coaching staff is looking forward to it.
Coach, I mean, you mentioned 18 years as a head coach of this program. Is there a point that you can kind of pinpoint when recruiting in Arizona really kind of started to take off the way it has, maybe not necessarily with a player, but just when you started noticing that the overall depth coming from the Valley and the state overall was really on the up?
You know, it's really difficult to put it to a year, but there's definitely been a trend. You know, we like the model of having at least half your team from the state of Arizona. It helps in so many other ways with alumni relations, with, you know, the team having an identity and a commonness about them. So, you know, our commitment to have 50% of our team from the state of Arizona has helped our team chemistry. And the guys come into the locker room and everybody has a sense of who they are. And maybe you don't know them directly, but you know of them. And so there's respect coming in already. And so it's been really in the last 7 or 8 years, though, the number of prospects that have been available to us in the state and being able to fill our roster the way that we have is very exciting, because that's been kind of the program model we wanted. At least half, and we'll be able to surpass that, I believe. You know, these kids continue to emerge, continue to find NAU as the best-kept secret in the state of Arizona, and those are the things you're starting to see happen.
Coach, I want to talk a little bit briefly about your class, then we'll get into spring ball, which you start next week. Great offensive line class, three guys that really could have been fringe Power 5 conference players. You were able to scoop them up and keep them in state, and Chase Larita, Luke Rudolph, and Stephen Bailey. And then also, Casey Yon had a great career, small school running back. You could have Casey Yon 2.0 and Joe Logan coming over from Estrella Foothills coming down, another small school running back that could kind of pick up right where he left off.
We're very fortunate to have found Joe Logan. You know, I think our coaching staff did a great job recruiting him. Yes, he came from a smaller school, but he is a dynamic running back. I mean, he's got speed, he's got power, he's got, you know, great change of direction, and he's got the heart of a lion. And we're excited about what Joe brings to the table. And it's hard to get that guy to say 10 words in any setting. He's a lot like Casey that way. But, you know, those kids that come out of the smaller school, I think, have a chip on their shoulders, something to prove. And for Casey, it worked out awesome. I mean, what a tremendous young man he was in our program. And we see Joe Logan in the same light. He's a fine young man. We're excited about him in our program.
And finally, March 22nd, it's the big day to start spring football. What's on your agenda? What are you hoping to accomplish, to see? Every coach has a different perspective this time of year. What do you guys need to do to make sure you're best set up for the fall?
I think in college football, when you look at year to year, you know, you have a lot of guys return, and you'll have new guys that you blend, but every football team is different. You really, when January, February rolls around, you're into your off season, you're rebuilding the new team. So the 2016 team, you know, we'll carry some of the things that we remember were good for us last fall, but nothing in last fall is going to help us or hurt us coming into this year. So we need to rebuild the chemistry again and redefine the things and the details that it takes that we believe to be a champion. And we've become so close in the last 4 years, each year playing for something at the end of the year. And I really believe the longer you knock on that door, you're going to get through that. And so this is a significant step in our offseason to continue to build a strong, you know, team chemistry and to improve fundamentally. You know, we didn't lose coaches, so we have a lot of continuity on the practice field. And so we want to see ourselves get better in every aspect of our game so we can take on the challenging season that opens with Arizona State and and then it goes on from there.
Coach, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It's the Brad Sesmat Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. Awesome guests today, Kyle Odegaard, Jerome Sowers. Really good show. Appreciate having them on. Going to talk this segment a little bit more March Madness. I know we dabbled in it off the top of the show. The matchup coming up between U of A and Wichita State. It's not going to be an easy one for the Wildcats. You know, I'm a U of A graduate. Obviously like to see them do well and go far. But this is not going to be easy. Wichita State, fantastic defensive team. They allow under 60 points per game. Yes, they don't play in the Pac-12 or a Power 5 conference, which obviously helps. You're not playing the same talent night in and night out. But still holding a Division I college team for a season long under 60 points, that tells you everything you need to know. This Wichita State team with Fred Van Fleet and Baker, the senior backcourt that they have, they went to the Elite Eight a few years ago and played against Ohio State, an Ohio State team that just so happened to knock off U of A in the Sweet 16 that year. That was with Nick Johnson and company. So this is a Wichita State team that you can't look at as your typical mid-major. They have players that are used to playing this time of year, and they have the numbers that back up everything that it takes to be a good March Madness team. Guard play, experience, defense, rebounding. The only thing about them that I feel like can be exploited in a way that U of A could win and win comfortably is if they get to the foul line. And I mentioned that off the top. I didn't even know there were this many teams, but Wichita State is 329th in the country. 329 teams. You think just 68 make the tournament. That actually makes the tournament seem smaller than it really feels with 68 teams being selected. But they were 329th in the country at free throw attempts allowed per field goal. Allowed. There's a little advanced stat for you. So with guys like Alonzo Trier, who are phenomenal at getting to the foul line, Ryan Anderson, the same, they need to attack the basket. They need to get to the line because that is how the Wildcats are going to be able to really take advantage of the weaknesses that Wichita State presents. Looking at the Wildcats sort of thing, because I feel like I focused more on Wichita State in the first segment and the matchup and here presently, Arizona has been all over the map this season. I'm not telling you breaking news here. There have been times where they have looked phenomenal, like the Stanford game and the Cal game. Both of those games, they looked spectacular. They looked great in the second half of the UCLA game both times, both up in L.A. and in Tucson, even though they lost one of those games. They looked really good in Utah on the road, even though they just fell short in the second half. But there's a theme here. Putting together a full 40 minutes has been an issue. In both of those UCLA games I mentioned, they didn't do that. In the Utah game, they didn't do that. Against Colorado in the Pac-12 tournament, they didn't do that. It was a tale of two completely different halves. And against Oregon, they were severely outplayed against Oregon in the first half of the Pac-12 semifinal game, the Pac-12 tournament. And then they come back and force overtime. Granted, it was a wild finish, and Oregon basically did everything they could to throw that game away to allow the overtime to even happen. But U of A needs to put together a full 40 minutes. And it's going to be hard to do that once the elevation, if they can continue to win and make a run, get through the first weekend against Wichita State and most likely Miami. They need to be able to play a full 40 minutes. That means consistent play on both ends of the floor from guys like Ryan Anderson and Dusan Ristic and Parker Jackson Cartwright and Kadeem Allen. Those are guys that we have seen do this, a roller coaster, where at some points they look fantastic and some points they've really struggled. Gabe York, for the most part, has been very consistent in his play. Sure, there have been times where he's disappeared over the course of a game, but at the end of the day, he's shot the ball well, and he's been consistent enough on both ends of the floor with what they're going to get out of him. And Alonzo Trier has a tendency to try to do a little bit too much with the ball in his hands, but other times he looks like the most experienced and most talented player on the floor for either team. I'm going to bring in Kyler now. Kyler Mead, our savvy intern, talk a little college hoops. Let's talk U of A Wichita State before we talk about the rest of your bracket, which I'm sure is going to finish last in your pool. I'm going to be last too. I'll be second to last if we were in one together because I know I'll beat you. But This U of A Wichita State matchup, what kind of stands out to you when looking at the numbers and look at the players on the floor?
I think this is the hardest matchup that they've got in front of them until they get to the Elite Eight. I think if they can get past this matchup, I think they've got an Elite Eight run in them. You mentioned the free throw issues. You mentioned that Wichita State has given up. You mentioned the talent that U of A has on the floor. This isn't a U of A team that I love, really. But I think if they can get past Wichita State, and I do think they will because I think they're better coached overall. I think they have better talent overall. I think they can play against the weaknesses that Wichita State has. I think if they can get past Wichita State, I don't see anyone standing between them and an Elite Eight run.
Yeah, you make an interesting point because you have Miami in the second round, a 3 seed. I actually thought that was a little bit generous, but you can't shy away from their RPI and you can't shy away from some of the wins they have.
And that's if Miami gets past Buffalo, which is a tough squad.
This is true. Buffalo was in the tournament last year with Bobby Hurley, and so they know what they're doing this time of year based on the experience they had last year. And then you're right. You have Villanova sitting right there. You know, Villanova has knocked U of A out of the tournament in the past. This is a Villanova team that at one point this year was number one in the country. Granted, it was very short because they lost the week they were given the number one ranking. You could be looking at a run into the Elite Eight and leave it – Kyler, leave it to this U of A team to make it to the Final Four compared to the teams they've had the last couple
of
years.
Right. Isn't that what they would do with this team without the star power? They were seeded sixth. That's exactly what a team like this would do, is they would just make it to the Elite Eight, win a crazy game, make it to the Final Four. I think that's entirely possible. I wouldn't pick them to the Final Four, but I think if they can get past this Wichita State team, which is going to be tough for them, I think Elite Eight's totally possible.
Yeah, well, they got Kansas in their region. I have Kansas winning the whole thing in my bracket.
I have Kansas in the
I think
final
a lot
four.
Of people will, but if you want to win your pools, you got to pick the winner. You know, I know a lot of people that are like in their brackets, you know, I'm not going to pick Kansas because everyone's going to pick Kansas.
Right.
The way you win the bracket at the end of the day isn't by picking the upsets in the first round or two. It's by picking the Final Four and picking the winner.
Yeah, because the points are worth so much more as you get up.
So much more. So I'm going to pick the team that I think is going to win and then hope I get lucky in the first two rounds. Let's talk a little bit upsets. Kyler, do you have your bracket in front of you?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So here's a couple that I pointed out, and some people are going to think I'm crazy, but this is just what I see. The Ivy League the last few years,
you're stealing mine,
has not only finally gotten teams into the tournament, well, they do every year, but has finally broken through and gotten wins like we saw Harvard do a couple years ago.
Yep.
But they're getting wins. Yale sits here in a first round matchup against Baylor. Baylor is one of the most potent offenses in the country, not just the Big 12. They are also one of the worst defenses and one of the worst rebounding teams in the country. Rebounding and defense are 1 and 1A next to guard play in my big three in order to be a successful tournament team. And they're missing two of those three in a severe way. I could easily see a veteran-led Ivy League sharpshooting Yale team knock off Baylor in the first round as that famous 12-5 upset.
Yep, they're my 12-5 as well. You stole mine. And part of it's just because it's fun to root for Yale.
Yeah.
But part of it's because, just like everything you just said, the Ivy League, nobody watches them play. And so it's kind of coming out of nowhere, but it's guys that are talented, guys that obviously are smart, obviously well-coached, and they have the components for that 12-5 upset. So I agree with that one. I like that.
Iona against Iowa State.
Ooh.
4 seed versus a 13 seed, and we've seen 13 seeds win the last couple years. You heard of a guy named A.J. English?
Hmm.
A.J. English, one of the most prolific scorers in college basketball this season at Iona. Iona had a battle with Monmouth all across conference play and in their conference tournament, finally knocked them off. Monmouth alone as a mid-major was a bubble team.
Right.
Normally, mid-majors aren't bubble teams.
Right.
They had a good enough schedule and a good enough amount of wins. So those are two teams. Granted, the conference as a whole isn't like what you'd see from a Power Five, but those two teams duked it out, played really hard. They're both tournament level capable. And Iowa State's a team, I don't know, with a coach in their first year and are coming off a year where they totally imploded in the first round, are going to have so much pressure on them to not do it again that they might do it again. I see Iona pulling the 13-4 upset over Iowa State.
Yeah, I like that. That's solid. I don't have that picked, but I think that makes sense. Iowa State's, I don't know, I saw a couple Iowa State games this year, and I think they've got the talent to hold on. But I do like that pick if I'm looking for an upset. Yeah. I've got Buffalo upsetting Miami, actually, kind of helping out Arizona a little bit.
Well, how so? What do you see from the
things
we mentioned?
Well, I think Buffalo, a lot of the guys that we talked about, I think Miami got overrated this year. They've got a good RPI. Yeah, they've played a good, but you just, if you win in the ACC, that's going to happen. The ACC was weird this year.
Was weird.
It was talented teams losing just in weird times, and Miami just kind of was able to ride that wave and come out on top. I think Buffalo, coming off, Bobby Hurley's former team, obviously it's a very different team. But I think that they've got the pieces in place. They've got the pedigree in place. I think they've got a chance to upset a team that isn't seated where it should be in Miami.
What are your thoughts on Northern Iowa? Now, Northern Iowa is playing Texas, and it's really hard to pick against Shaka Smart
right
in the first round, or in any round, really. And Texas has some talent. I watched them a few times this year. But Northern Iowa beat Kansas in the tournament a few years back. And Northern Iowa, who'd they beat earlier this year?
They knocked off the one seed.
They walked off the number one team in the country.
I forget which one. All these Iowa teams beat number one overall teams.
They did. Iowa State and Northern Iowa all beat a number one ranked team this year at some point. That's an interesting note. Northern Iowa has a very similar makeup of a team that they did when they beat Kansas a few years back, with some great shooters on the outside, and they're not afraid. And this isn't like it's a big matchup. It's a 6 against an 11. I'm going to burst the bubbles of all these people that want to see Texas against Texas A&M, that rivalry, since they don't have it, since they're in different conferences now. But I can see Northern Iowa knocking off the Shaka Smarts.
I could see that. I'm not picking that. I like Shaka Smart. I think this Texas team is better than it's been in the last several years. I haven't seen a lot of Northern Iowa, to be honest, so I can't speak that much to it. But I think Texas and Shaka Smart are just – coaching matters so, so much in the tournament. And I think Shaka Smart's going to find a way to win at least that game. I see Texas going down to A&M, who – conference rivalry or not, A&M hates Texas so bad.
Yes.
And I spent some time in College Station a few years back, and just the power of hatred there.
Everyone wants that matchup.
Yeah, I know, and I'm sucker to that. I think that's good.
Because I initially picked Northern Iowa just because I think it's a good story, and teams like that, win in the tournament.
Uh-huh.
But man, you're looking at national championship intensity if Texas A&M and Texas can play in a weekend matchup against one another. I'm curious. You watched a lot of Pac-12, Kyler.
Yeah.
Seven teams, record-setting, from the conference this year. Who are the teams that you like? Who are the teams from a subjective point of view that you see, regardless of the road that's ahead of them, just teams that have the makeup that could be good?
I like Cal. They've got two great guards and a solid big man in Ivan Robb. I don't think that they make it really far because they've got a tough road, but I think they're a good team that could possibly find their way into an upset. I don't have them upsetting anybody, but I think they make their way until that far. I like Oregon, but I don't love them as a one seed. I don't think they make it out of that bracket, honestly. I think that they have a nice little run. And I think it helps that they got the one seed because they have an easier road. But Oregon, honestly, I see going down before the Final Four. I like Duke coming out of that bracket.
Yeah, and see, that's where I disagree with you. And I think Oregon, not only getting a one seed is huge, but also the bracket that they're in. Duke was unranked a few weeks ago. Duke against Notre Dame, who lost to North Carolina by, it seemed like, 50 points in the ACC tournament, gave up a 21-2 run in the second half to ultimately lose in overtime. This team is erratic, and I love Brandon Ingram.
Yeah, that's kind of where it's coming from for me.
And Grayson Berry, as much as you want to hate him, he is a really good player too. They have Chase Jeter, who I got to watch in person when he was at Bishop Gorman. They played out here, and he went to Duke. They have loads of talent, and talent alone can get you through the first weekend plus in the NCAA tournament. But they are erratic.
And I think this is the thing for me is that, they've had a crazy season, but it's not just talent. First of all, big thing in the tournament is matchups. 6'9 guard and Brandon Ingram is a matchup nightmare for everyone they're going to see.
Yeah, but they've got Elgin Cook, who's what, 6'7", 6'8"?
Yeah, and listen, it's not going to be easy for them, but I think that the other thing is they're so well coached, obviously, But they've also been through so much this year that so much of the time Duke gets to the tournament as a 2 seed or a 3 seed or a 1 seed, and then they lose early. I think it's because nothing happened to them in the season. They don't know how to overcome adversity. This Duke team has overcome adversity. I think they have a chance to make it to the Final Four.
They definitely have. But to be honest, when I'm looking at this West bracket, Oregon's potential matchup with Cincinnati in the second round almost scares me more for Oregon.
That's fair.
Than Duke does. And Duke has the pedigree. They have the experience. So that alone makes it a good game. And then Oklahoma, if they play Oklahoma, say in the Elite Eight, say they're the 2 seed and they go all the way through with their bracket. Oklahoma has been really inconsistent. Yeah. They have another guy that you have to love in Buddy Hield.
He's incredible.
But the rest of the team has been so inconsistent. Oregon has matchups in front of them where they are easily the most consistent team in this bracket.
I agree with you. I'm not picking them to come out, and it's not because I don't think they're a good team. I think they're a great team, and I think the bracket they're in and the seed they got is going to help them. I think they have certainly the best chance of any team out of the Pac-12 to make Final Four bid in the last, well, I guess since UA a couple of years ago when they failed to.
Yeah.
I think they have a great chance to make it to the Final Four. I just don't see them getting past. If they do have to get past either Oklahoma or Duke, I think that's going to be just a little bit too much for them.
Well, I'm with you on Cal. Cal's going up against Maryland, who is loaded with talent and have Melo Trimble as one of my favorite guards in the country. They also have Rashid Suleiman, a former Duke guy.
Right.
So that's going to be potentially a really, really tough second-round matchup. And if they get – what's your reward if you win that game? You most likely play Kansas.
Right.
So the top end of that South bracket is just ridiculous. I like Oregon State to get out of the first round. The only Pac – I normally go heavy Pac-12, maybe because I'm biased. But the numbers back it up. Pac-12 teams win in the first round. That's what they've done the last several years. And the only team I don't have winning out of the Pac-12 in the first round is USC. USC kind of stumbles here into the NCAA tournament after the hot start that they were at. They play a team in Providence who beat Arizona in a tournament earlier this season. It prevented Arizona from playing Michigan State, which would have been great for their strength of schedule and RPI. Arizona, I believe, is a 6 seed because of that loss, because the loss not only had them lose to a team that barely got into the tournament in the end in Providence, they really limped in. And if they were a loss or two away from not being in at all based on after how they started the season, but also lost the chance of playing Michigan State, who's a 2 seed. So that game right there alone cost them from being at least a top 5 seed. I like Providence because Chris Dunn is incredible, and they also have some good players inside. But other than that, I like Pac-12 across the board winning in the first round. I like Cal. I like Oregon. I like Arizona. I like Oregon State. Who am I missing here? Utah.
Colorado.
I like Utah to get into the Sweet 16. Because they've got everything you want in a tournament team with
between Utah a lot.
Defense, guard play, and size with Jakob Poeltl. And they got, an easy road out of the first weekend because Gonzaga is not your typical Gonzaga team. And Seton Hall just had a great run in their conference tournament and found themselves into a 6 seed. I'm not big on Seton Hall. I think Gonzaga wins that game, and I think Utah does work on Gonzaga to get themselves into the Sweet 16. So that's we get to watch it all tomorrow. We sound all smart right now, Kyle, but really we do not know anything.
Everyone's a genius
because
before
no
it starts.
One knows anything when it comes to this tournament. The one thing I will tell you, though, none of these teams that are 5, 6, 7 seed or lower are going to get into the Final Four. I hate to break it to you. It just doesn't happen statistically. You know, I'd like to sit here and say that a U of A team could end up there in the Final Four. I don't think it's the year. I don't think it's the year that a mid-major or a low-seeded team goes on a run and makes it in there, because at the end of the day, it's the power conferences that and the top of the power conferences that ultimately win out. It's just statistically a fact. And so don't get too crazy with your brackets. Thanks a lot, Kyler, for your help. My name is Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat today. Again, special thanks to Jerome Sauer. Special thanks to Kyle Odegaard for joining us on the show. I'll be back tomorrow to talk more as March Madness will be underway. Favorite time of year. Can't wait. Have a great rest of your Wednesday.